pals o' mine. Enjoyed another rainy day yesterday here in Northern California, where we so desperately need it. I was listening to an oldie station on the car radio, trying not to get hit by incompetent drivers who refused to turn on headlights or turn signals during a torrential downpour. When the song, "Listen to the Rhythm of the Falling Rain," started playing. So I started singing. Nothing like music for a little stress relief. When my ex-husband and I would fight, he could relieve his stress by going to the bar he managed for free drinks. That was so unfair. I mention him only because I saw him for the first time in about 17 years recently. It was good, actually. Amicable and all that. Time really does help. Do you remember the first time you ordered a drink in a bar? I do, because it was so embarrassing. I moseyed up to the bar, keep trying to act like a veteran drinker. "What can I get you?" he asked. "I'd like a VO9. "You want a hair cream?" "7, VO7. Coolness shut down in flames. Beer, on the other hand, was fairly simple, as there were limited choices back then. Now, man, I can't keep up with all the choices out there. Home brewers are segueing from hobby to business. I wrote an article last year on the anniversary of the end of Prohibition. I came across this poem, but didn't know who wrote it, about the originally necessitated home brewers during that time. Mothers in the kitchen, washing out the jugs. Sisters in the pantry, bottling the suds. Fathers in the cellar, mixing up the hops. Johnny's on the porch, watching for the cops. I enjoyed an informative conversation with beer aficionado Rick Sellers about all things beer. When I was born, my father still had a couple semesters left in college. So my parents married, they had very little money, very little. So I was raised, and I still hear it periodically, the old, "I only had one six-pack a week" story. Mm-hmm. One day you couldn't have that beer.
Right.
And on top of that, you had to decide, do I have the beer before dinner or after?
Mm.
Olympia. That was the cheapest beer that was around. So we were raised with Oli, cans of Oli. What about you? Did you have any in your family?
Yeah, we had a kegerator at the house, and my dad always had Coors Light. I had a side chore where I'd get him his beer, you know, pour the beer in the glass and take it to him. And my reward is I got to sip the beer. So I still, to this day, have an affinity for Coors Light. My family, for special occasions, whether it be marriages or deaths or something like that, Deschutes Black Butte Porter. I grew up in Oregon.
Oh, okay.
And so it was an Oregon brewery. It's my sentimental beer. I can't just drink it on a normal basis, but if I'm celebrating or mourning or just introspective, that's usually the beer that I associate both my family, my history, my background. So those two beers, for very, very different reasons, that's what I grew up with.
The other one was Buckhorn.
I don't know Buckhorn.
Well, there's a reason. I think it was like 1% alcohol, maybe not even that. It was almost predominantly water.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad I missed that one.
So it must have been interesting during Prohibition, because obviously beyond the bathtub, gin stories you always hear about, home brews, I guess, really became massively produced out of need.
Prohibition was, it was a time for people to experiment with home brewing. From a broader perspective on the home brewing front, you know, that was a response or a reaction to the Industrial Revolution. You know, before everything became industrialized, we had a vast variety of beer styles. They ran the gamut of pale to dark, heavy body to light, traditional beers from all over the world. We kind of lost those when, through industrialization, we went to pale, clear, light beers. And Prohibition kind of solidified that, and the home brewers tried to replicate those easy to make, lower alcohol, quick turnaround beers. But it's interesting that from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, we lost so much, not just in beer, but in bread and cheese. All these things became white, pale, bland, consistent. Yeah, I mean, Prohibition was what it was, but it was at a time where food and drink in general were becoming mass-produced, sterile, bland, and that's what we wanted. We wanted consistency. We We love that we could press buttons or just put things down the assembly line and get the same consistent product.
Do you think we really want that, or is that just what we were told that we wanted?
I think we did want it. I think it was so new and so exciting. We see that a little bit right now with the imminent coming of the driverless car. I equate those things together. Like, there's such excitement from one hand, this one group of people, that we celebrate the technology, we celebrate the advances we have, and it's exciting, it's fresh, it's new. And you have the people that's like, you know what? I like to drive a car. I like driving. So you're always going to have that. I think for a lot of people, that Wonder Bread, Velveeta cheese, industrial beer, industrial liquor, all those things, industrial coffee. I mean, Folgers was the thing. So something happened. Yeah, something happened in the 1960s where all that changed. But from the early 1900s through Prohibition, through the World Wars, part of it was a rationing. There was such a different culture where we were all in it together. We loved the efficiency of the products that we could create. But yeah, somewhere in the 1960s, you know, the guy started Pete's Coffee in Oakland. We got Fritz Maytag buying Anchor Brewing. You start seeing artisan cheeses, artisan breads. The whole movement really started in the late 60s and picked up steam in the late 80s. And now we're not really inundated, but we're back to what we used to be, where you could buy old school breads of any style you want, cheeses of every variety, beers, rows and rows dedicated just to beer. Where, I mean, growing up, that was not the case at all.
No, it wasn't.
I mean, that was 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. So it's exciting, but I don't know where it's going to go. The trends go up and down and sideways all the time. So right now, we're enjoying the ride. As beer enthusiasts, we love it. Who knows?
Well, and of course, it's the same with wine.
Yeah,
of course. You have rows of wine, yeah. Even alcohol for that.
Yeah.
On a recent podcast, I hosted a virtual pub crawl, crawl, Killarney, County Kerry, by a gentleman who owns a touring company of Ireland. And he was talking about the Irish cocktail.
Okay.
He says, we don't have margaritas or daiquiris. We have the Irish cocktail, which is basically you fill your mouth with a high-quality whiskey, and then you add to it some wheat beer or some Belgium type.
Okay.
And you mix them together in your mouth.
Sounds terrible.
But actually, because we were at his home, uh-huh. And we were drinking Redbreast, which is 20-year-old aged whiskey. Yes, very smooth.
Yeah.
And so I have to tell you, it was very smooth. Yeah. I think with a cheap whiskey, yeah. It would have been horrible.
Huh.
And it reminded me of something I'd heard on the radio years ago, where someone was talking about blue-collaring your drink, which sounds very similar, where you have a glass of your favorite alcohol,
right,
scotch whiskey, and then you pour some beer on top of it.
Right. I work behind a bar. I see people doing that. Not all the time, but I certainly do see it.
Do
where
you?
People will buy a very high-end scotch or whiskey. They'll be paying upwards of $20, $25 for a shot, and they'll want to add to it. And I'm a purist. I love the liquid, and love the liquid in its purest form. I do love cocktails, but for me, if I'm making an old-fashioned or a Sazerac, there are certain whiskeys that I will use. I don't want cheap stuff. I would find it difficult to appreciate, you know, a $25 shot of whiskey when you're adding sugars or other flavors to it. Because I've been to the distilleries. I've been to the places that make some really high-end, wonderful spirits. And I just can't imagine adding to it. But people do it. They've been doing that for years, and it's cool that people are doing that. And for a lot of people, that's a way to... That's the only way they can drink some of these higher-end spirits. A lot of them, you say they're smooth. For a lot of consumers, like a Redbreast is fairly abrasive or hot. They're used to basically vodka drinks. So they're trying to make it as sweet, mellow, and...
Then they shouldn't be drinking it.
That's kind of where... Yeah, but if people want to do it, my thought is trust your palate. Been around fine beers and fine spirits for a long time, but if somebody wants Coors Light or Stoli or whatever, God bless you. Enjoy. Like, who am I to say that what you're doing is wrong? And if you don't care for the spirits or the beers I like, it doesn't make you wrong. It doesn't make me right. It just, everyone's got to trust their own palate.
Well, it's not wrong or right, but it just seems it defeats the purpose on purchasing a higher end when you don't. People would look at me and laugh when I'd say, order a Bourbon 7, but I prefer JD and 7, and they said, well, you wouldn't know the difference because it's mixed. I said, but I do. If you hand me one with Old Crow, I'm going to taste the difference.
Right.
Only because it used to be my go-to drink.
Yeah.
But if you don't drink that often, then I don't think your palate would be that sensitive.
That's true. We're again, we have a whole generation of new drinkers that there's not a lot of education. This is all new. You look at these super high-end bourbons, your rye whiskeys, your scotches. These are all products that came back into play in the late 80s. And so there's an education gap that's not there. And people, they look at price tags a lot of times and just say, well, that's got to be good because it's $25 a shot. So I'll get that because I want to be sophisticated.
Right.
They don't necessarily know the difference between the regions of Scotland and the different whiskeys they make, or whiskey in America versus whiskey in Ireland, or whiskey in Scotland, whiskey in Japan. There's just one lump category. You have brown spirits and clear spirits. And people know they like gin or they like vodka. And whiskey for a lot of people is just whiskey. If you're a fan of an American rye and you don't understand the differences of everything and you order a Lagavulin 16, you pay $20 a shot for it, that peaty, smoky, almost plasticky presence is going to be so overpowering. It's funny to me because I see people doing a Lagavulin Coke. I'm like, you really don't want to do this. I know what you're trying to do. This is not where you're going to get it. You don't want a smoky Coke. Most of the time, they'll take my advice. But a few people, to them, it's just whiskey. And they'll do the log and Coke, and they'll return it almost all the time.
Well, it's like I've seen furniture that's mahogany, beautiful piece of mahogany, and they're just painting over it. Not staining, even. Just painting.
Right.
And I'm nonplussed.
Yeah, it's... We do that all the time.
There's a lot involved with brewing.
Mm-hmm.
The barrels... The land, well, the hops start with the plants. Here's the soil, the climate.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many variables involved. Is there a way, a cheat sheet of sort, if somebody was interested in a certain region in a country, or just because of the climate, or just to give them a head start, or is it just a roll of the dice?
There's two different factors there. The raw ingredients that you're talking about, the barley or the wheat or the hops, they are all processed ingredients before the brewer gets to them. So you're not going to get the sense of terroir that you're going to get in wine. That said, there are regional variances in brewing or in taste. So you're up in the northeast states, where it's colder more often than it is on the west coast, you'll find a lot more sturdier beers. Those beers that are sweeter, heavier, certainly full of flavor, but they're not going to be the light, crisp, refreshing beers we have in California. And that's a stylistic change. Pretty much brewers around the world have access to the same raw or processed ingredients. So when you're buying barley, you're buying it from a middleman. Barley has been, once it's been picked, it's been malted, it's been kilned, and sometimes roasted. And so you're going to get varying flavors of your ingredients. And it doesn't matter whether barley was grown in Canada or North Dakota or Germany. Each one will have its own subtle flavors. You'll get some that has more caramel flavor, more this and that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the beer is going to, you're going to find a flavor that is reminiscent of the plains of Canada or the plains of North Dakota. I'd say the regional tastes are driven a lot by temperature, climate, the food scene. I think in California, we are in a hop craze right now. IPAs, double IPAs, triple IPAs. We can't throw enough hops at people. And for an outsider or for many purists, they're too bitter, they're too hoppy, they're out of balance. And they are. They really are. If you're looking from a traditional standpoint, they are definitely aggressive. But you know what? We like our Mexican food with the hottest pepper sauce you could ever find. We expect to have our palates blown out every time we go out. We want the richest, fattiest food. You know, the pork belly craze is big in California too. Not just California, but we're after really intense flavors. Your coffee is getting bolder and stronger and more potent every year. And I look at that and I just say, well, the hoppy beer makes sense to me. We're looking for an assault on our palate. We want an impact that we've never appreciated before. We've, for years and probably say centuries, have wanted balance. We've wanted that fine restraint that we've seen in old world cooking. Old world brewing, the wines of, they're definitely more balanced, more delicate, more subtle. And that's just not who we are in California, Oregon, Washington. The entire western region of the U.S. is... We're brash, we're bold, we're... Maybe it's unrefined, who knows? But we like intensity.
New York always claims that's where all the immigrants came in, and so that's the hub of this country.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But in a bigger picture, the ones who didn't want to be part of the hub came across the country, came around the horn.
Right.
And so that's how California, well, the California of today, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Mexicans and the Native Americans
yeah.
May disagree, but... Those who emigrated is my point, immigrated. They were the mixed nuts to begin with.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's seriously not just making the joke of the nuts and granola and the crazy people, but it's those who want something different. It's not outside the box. There is no box.
Right. There's no box.
And that's when why people keep coming out here.
Yeah.
We're starting something new and different. It's not the same old black hole, which back east can be sometimes when it comes to these type of areas.
That's true. For my world, the Bruin world, we're having an identity crisis. You know, we've long wanted the German tradition of brewing, which is colder fermentation, cleaner beers, all subtle balanced. We have an influx of Belgian tradition, which is kind of a F it, let it go. They're wonderful beers, but they're polar opposites of what they would do in Germany. And now we have this American tradition where young homebrewers are opening their places as homebrewers. They're not going through a brewer's guild. They're not going through a formal education process. But what they're doing is playing, and playing very well. And they're coming up with, you know, you mentioned barrels earlier. The idea of putting beer into a bourbon barrel is very, very new. It was started by a gentleman out of Chicago. Actually, his name is Todd Ashman. It was kind of, let's see what happens. Todd Ashman now is at 50-50. He's arguably like the master or the godfather of bourbon barrel aged beers. And his Eclipse series fetches a lot of dollars. His playing, or I shouldn't say playing because that's offensive to his trade. His curiosity, his insistence of doing something different or more, something just unique, led him to this thing now. We have a craze across the country where it's not just bourbon barrels anymore. You got rum barrels. We're doing brandy barrels. If there's wood that had liquor in it, or even Tabasco sauce. I mean, there's a brewer out in the East Coast doing Tabasco aged beers. That all started with just like, you know, what can I do different? And that's also kind of a new world American thing. Like, what can I do? And we still have what's called a style guideline. Brewers brew to a style, whether it's a pale ale, a porter, or a stout. That was your basically the box you were in that brew, and you're trying to brew to that style, the specs, the ingredients. We've really thrown those out. We're putting ingredients together in beer that have never been put together before. Some of it is a happy accident. A lot of it is deliberate, careful analysis of the ingredients. We know more about our raw ingredients across the board than we ever have in our lives. You know, there's a great book in my library somewhere. It's the Food Bible. Literally any home cook or home brewer or people that play with ingredients, it's not a cookbook. It's how to write a cookbook. It's how to write a recipe. It lists every ingredient out there, what plays, what contrast. It's an amazing book. And I think a lot of brewers have taken that mentality. It's like, I have this ingredient over here, be it coconut. I have a coconut beer at the bar right now. It's like, well, what do you do with coconut? Well, we roast them. We like the nuttiness that roasting brings out. Well, what's nutty? Well, we got brown ales, some porters. What happens if we put those together and we get basically like a macaroon? You get that in a bottle now. And I think there's a thought process that we've never had before. Like, we want to, you approach it two ways. You could say, I want to have a macaroon flavored beer. How do I do it? And you can just deconstruct it the way chefs do. Or you can look at your raw ingredients and say, well, I know these ingredients play well together because I like this end product over here. I like a macaroon. So chocolatey malt plus toasted coconut should work. And it does work.
It sounds pretty good, actually.
It works really darn well. But this is all new. Like, we took beer brewing so seriously for so many centuries. You know, that was something that in the old, old world was run by the church because your beer was cleaner than water. And so your community was encouraged to drink beer on a daily basis. So beer had to be low in alcohol, so you're not getting people drunk. It had to be pleasurable. And there were penalties for brewers if they made too high alcohol beers or beers that were too offensive to the palate. And then we did that for centuries. When it became a tradition that was out of the church's control, we still stuck to some of those, this is what beer is. And now we've just thrown it all out the window. And it's amazing. It doesn't always work. I mean, there's some pretty bad ideas out there. I had a smoked pumpkin brown ale last year that on paper, I'm sure it sounded really good. They smoked whole pumpkins, put it into the mix, and it was vile. It was offensive. But, you know, it was a small batch.
They got rid of it for people who just wanted to try it, probably.
And then there's, you know, at the Great American Beer Festival in 2008 or 9, Blue Moon came out with a peanut butter beer, which sounds terrible. I mean, it really sounds terrible. So in my mind, I have to try it.
Curiosity.
And you know what? That was really good. And today we're seeing more and more peanut butter chocolate beers on the market. And we don't see a lot of them, but I've seen three or four in the last year that have been on tap. And we're in this place now where there is no rule, there's no direction, there's no governing body saying this is what beer has to be, and consumers are loving it. I would say not a majority, but a lot of your passionate beer enthusiasts, they're looking for something they've never had before, and this is a great time to do it.
It's the Holy Grail.
It is. It's
the movable Holy Grail.
It's the ever-growing bucket list. You have beers you want to try, and
buckets of beers.
You want to try them for another reason other than you've never had before.
Whenever I hit a bar that has a lot of brews, I always try something I haven't had before. Yeah. If that's an option. Sometimes they only have the same.
I had a regular yesterday at work. He uses an application on his phone. I think it's called Untappd. I don't use it. It's great for people that want to keep track of all the beers they drink. Whenever you load a beer into there, it automatically checks you into the location, or you tell them what location you're drinking that beer at. Our bar has been open just over 4 years, and he told me yesterday he had his 562nd different beer, unique beer, at our bar alone.
Cool.
We've only been there for 4 years. I know he's had some of the same beers twice, or several times. I'm like, to me, that's just it's an amazing thing. He's not even trying. He's not at what we call tickers. He's not out looking for every new beer. But he just wants to try something new. He's not standing in line. He's not trading for beers across the country, which is a growing hobby these days. He just casually orders different beer. And now he's, for my bar alone, in the last 4 years, over 560 beers. Unique beers. I'm just trying to wrap my head around that. When I started this gig, 10, 12 years ago, I don't think that was an option.
No.
It's just amazing to me.
Explain to me red beer, because I know some breweries produce red beer, but others just add red to it. I mean, can you actually produce...
Like you have amber to add ale, red? Or you mean like a bloody beer?
So if I go to a brewery, a chain,
right,
and they have red beer on their menu...
Red ale, gotcha. There are two ways to do it. Some of your larger industrial breweries will add a caramel color to it, and that is not appreciated by the craft brewers or the craft brewing industry. The traditional way to add color is through adding caramel malts. And in the malting process, malting is basically a germination of the grain. And it's stopped when it's modified to the correct, basically, protein content and sugar content, or the starch content. And then it can be kilned, which is just a heating process or a cooking process. Your really pale malts, they're just pale in color. They're off-white to a yellow. Add some more temperature and time to it. They measure them in Lovibond, which is a term that, outside of beer, I don't know what it means, so I'm not a scientist. The scale is vast, so you can have a lightly toasted malt, which is still going to be fairly pale. You get to some of your caramel, where there's varying degrees of red in the color of the malt. It's all barley. It's all the same barley. It's all the same exact product, but they've just cooked it at different temperatures. The longer you cook it, or the longer you kiln it, the more color you get to the malt, the less viable it is as a sugar source for your yeast. Red beers, just malts that have been kilned to the desire of the brewer. And so whether it's a deep amber, a light gold, those are all considered caramel or red malts. Amber ale to amber ale could be hugely different. You get some that are a light golden color, and you get some that are almost brown in color, and you get a nice garnet hue on the side of the glass. You hold it up to a light. That's the proper way to add the color. And the same way with stouts and brown ales. All those varying colors you see largely come from the malting process, the kilning process of the malt. Our macro brewers, as I guess they're called, they will still use artificial colors or caramel dyes or liquids to get the color they want. And you can taste the difference. Like if you order a nationally distributed, national brand amber Bock, and you contrast that with a handcrafted small batch Bock beer that is either made in Germany or the U.S. or whatever, try those side by side. One's going to taste thin, slightly watery, and will not have a lot of complexity to it. Your traditional Bock will be a fuller body, layers of complexity. You'll get some fruity notes. You'll get some toasty, bready, sugary notes all from the malt. And that's just the one ingredient they're playing with. For me, the difference is night and day. I can tell a fake caramel beer versus a real caramel beer any day of the week.
Your discernible palate.
Yeah.
Well, it must have been fun, our recent beer week, to have people all over, all the different conversations you must have had.
We are just in an exciting time. It's not just Sacramento Beer Week or San Francisco Beer Week or any of the 60-plus beer weeks around the country. It seems like every day are being introduced to beer in a way that's for just lack of a better word, it's exciting. There's a buzz right now that's interesting. And beer weeks are, they're fun because they're concentrated events. They're high energy. A lot of people coming and trying to celebrate beer.
I like the food pairings.
Food pairings
they
is
need
really
to have
nice.
A little bit more of that. They didn't have too much of that.
Yeah, that's people take that way too seriously, though.
But like the idea of it.
Oh,
in other words, because the wine,
absolutely.
Of course, everybody has. And I just like the idea.
No, there's a wonderful book that was published, I think it was 2006 or 2007, by Garrett Oliver. And it's called The Brewmaster's Table. To me, that is the go-to book. If you want to pair a beer with your dinner or your dinner with your beer, it's spot on. The one thing in beer pairings that most cooks or bar people don't take into consideration is the body of beer. Focus on the flavors, which is great. You know, whether it's caramely or nutty or roasty or toasty or bready or sugary or just citrusy. Those are all important. Of more importance is knowing the food, fat content in the food. If you're doing a pork belly, which are two very different consistencies, but both quite fatty. I would say the most important thing you need to consider there is the body of the beer. Not the flavor of the beer. You want something effervescent, really tight bubbles you get mostly in bottle-conditioned beers. Because that effervescent quality will scrub your palate clean of any fats between the bites. It allows you both to appreciate every bite of food, but you'll get the complexities of the beer flavor all at the same time. It's really an amazing, often neglected part of beer pairing. Body of the beer, the carbonation of the beer. Your finer, like farmhouse ales out of Belgium, your bottle conditioned, super bubbly beers are great with fatty foods. Of course, knowing how to compare and contrast flavors is very important. But for anybody at home, or even professionally, that's new to the beer world, maybe new to the food world, if you want to marry those two together, The Brewmaster's Table is written by a beer person who loves food. And I've seen some beer pairings. I got every beer cookbook ever published. And it's obvious they're written by cooks who are not beer people. Because you'll see recipes, add a cup of beer to your mix. I'm like, well,
it doesn't specify the type.
Yeah, okay. I'll add a cup of beer. Is that an imperial stout? A lambic? Pale ale? Like, tell me like how that works. And there's very few people that understand that. One of the greatest beer cooks we have right now, he cooks with his food. He's in Sonoma. His name is Sean Paxton. And he does beer dinners around the country. If you ever have a chance to go to those, they're not inexpensive, but it's an experience that people who love food and love drink, he does stuff. Sean Paxton's nickname is the homebrew chef, and he creates recipes. He cooks every dish he cooks for his dinners. Beer is an ingredient in the food, whether it's a dressing, a marinade, and he pairs it oftentimes with the same beer or a beer that's going to contrast or complement the way he wants it to. And those are experiences that I have never seen anywhere else. And I, like you said, I would love to see more of that if it's done right. There are a few chefs in our region here in Sacramento that I think understand that. They often don't get the praise they deserve, but there's a guy in Fair Oaks. He runs Mighty Tavern. He's a beer guy. He's a cook who knows and loves beer. He's one of the few people I would put my palate into his hands. I'm a foodie. I'm a beer geek. I'm hard to please. I'm very opinionated. So there's a few chefs out there that I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to let you do your thing. You're right. I would love to see more thought put into that, more creative dishes and more food and beer pairings done properly. Buffalo Wild Wings now is offering beer pairing suggestions.
Okay, we don't need to have the lower level.
But it was just like, yeah, here you go. It's the thought process. There's got to be there. Just think about it.
Now, how far have you traveled to personally visit breweries?
Scotland. I've been all over the country. I had a job that afforded me that privilege where I would travel to breweries and bars and restaurants as a profession. Yeah, Northeast, Southeast, Midwest. There's not a lot of beer in this country I haven't had the pleasure of experiencing. There's a lot of new ones I haven't tried, obviously.
There's too many.
You can't keep up anymore. I mean, they can't keep up in my own little hometown of Sacramento. Like, we have 13 breweries opened up in 2013. We have 8 that have already opened up in 14. It's madness. And it's great. I think there's a paradigm shift. I hope there's a paradigm shift. Otherwise, we'll have a lot of closures in 3 or 4 years. But all over this country, there's amazing beer. One of my most pleasurable experiences was up in New Haven, Connecticut. And they're making a traditional Scotch ale. And I'm like, what makes it traditional? Because as much as I know about beer, there's a lot of like nuances I haven't read up on them. And we're going to boil this at a high boil, 4 to 6 hours. That's a long time. It's like, yeah, we're that caramel color you're trying to get. Like, we're going to caramelize the malt inside the kettle. Like, that's insane. That's really insane. And I tried the finished product and it was like
insanely good.
Really good. And then like down in San Diego, Port Brewing teamed up with Tanya Cornett, who's out of Bend, Oregon, and they did a style called a Stein beer. Again, obscure style I've never read up on, heard about, and I got to ask them, like, what Stein beer? It's like, well, yeah, we're going to superheat them, like red hot fiery rocks, and drop them into the beer. Like, my first thought is, A, that cannot be OSHA compliant. There's so many safety issues there. And B, like, who does that? But again, really amazing, intensely caramelized flavors. The superheated rock just drops right in there, and whatever that makes contact with that rock is instantly caramelized, almost smoky. Yeah, that works too. There's really very little out there that people aren't doing in this country. You know, Nebraska's got a killer sour beer program. Throughout the Midwest, they're barrel aging beers to perfection. And you got some bad ideas too. There was a brewer that last year decided to isolate the yeast that he found in his beard to make a beer.
In his beard?
His beard, yes.
Oh, that's repulsive on so many levels.
It is, really. That's when we start wondering if we're finally just going to jump the shark. We've done it in a way that I think is at a small enough scale now where we can just laugh at it and move on. I really hope that trend does not get much further. I've read terrible stories of ideas that brewers have, and I hope many of them never come to market. There's one guy that wants to use brains in his beer, which I...
Abbey Normal?
Oh, well.
Well, these international beer competitions are coming up, so how do you become a judge on one of those?
Your bigger competitions, the World Beer Cup and the Great American Beer Festival, you need to be nominated by somebody who's already a judge. And there's a vetting process that goes through that. Your smaller competitions, there's a international organization called the Beer Judge Certification Program, or BJCP. They have a website with a style manual, flavor guide, guide to off flavors. And it's not just about identifying off flavors in beer, but also it's meant mainly for homebrewers, where you can give them constructive criticism to get rid of the flavor in the next batch of beer they make. It's a great program. There are sanctioned competitions all over the country. And you don't need to be a certified beer judge. Again, you kind of need to be brought along into the fold by somebody who is a beer judge. Those are great programs to get started. For your commercial brewing, it's almost entirely made up of industry professionals, where they've been around beer for a long time. And that's why the World Beer Cup and the Great American Beer Fest is what it is. They're bringing in the top talent in the world. They're flying judges in from everywhere. And as a beer enthusiast, it's near impossible to get in as a judge on those. I have friends that judge it. I would never want to, but I mean, it'd be a fun notch on your belt, but it sounds like a lot of work to me. You're analyzing the color, the clarity, your head retention on the beers. All these things are factors in the quality of the beer. It sounds like a lot of fun if you're casual and you're like, oh, you got to drink beer for 4 hours. Well, I also wrote a whole lot of words down and tried to quantify why one beer is better than the other. It's easy to identify a bad beer, but when you get to that top level where you have four good beers in front of you, why does one deserve a gold and one deserve a silver?
That would be tough for me. Not just beer, but I just could not be a judge for any competition because I would feel so bad.
I've had the pleasure of sitting in on some best of show panels around the country, and I've also observed many of them. And that's good TV right there. Judging in general, boring stuff. Guys with bellies and beards and just writing notes and smelling their beer too much. That's pretty boring. But when you get to that top level, when it's the end of the competition, and they have the 8 best beers of everything, and they have to identify one that comes away with the medal, and there's some passionate debate that comes in there, and that to me is high level entertainment. You have people that they will bring out their style guidelines, and they'll be pointing to the words like, this doesn't have this or it has too much of this. You know, you start bringing in assumptions of the brewer's intention, all these. It's passionate on those big competitions. It's not a casual thing. I think your top level beer judges take it really seriously, and when they're at the opposite end of a spectrum with another high level, highly qualified judge, they have a very different opinion. It's great. I have too much fun watching that. A
lot of beer belly bumps.
Yeah. But it's a good time. It's a really good time. And that's something that I hope the casual beer person never gets too concerned about. Just enjoy the beer in your glass and move on. There's a lot of things we can take too seriously. If it's your hobby and if you have time to devote to whatever hobby you have, that's your hobby. But at the end of the day, beer is always going to just be beer. It should be. It should be a social lubricant, a drink of celebration, a drink of thought, a drink with your dinner. You can take it too seriously or you forget what beer is about, but at the end of the day, just enjoy your beer. Always, always enjoy your beer.
I really do want to check out that coconut-infused beer. We'll have to drop by this weekend. For this week's National Park Highlight, and my ongoing celebration of this year's 150th anniversary of the National Park System, I'm heading over to Ohio, to Dayton Aviation Heritage National Historic Park. The Wright brothers' first successful powered flight occurred at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, but Dayton is where they developed and built their design. Within the park, you can visit the Wright Cycle Company, the fourth bicycle shop operated by the Wrights, and where they began to actively research and develop their interest in flying. The Huffman Prairie Flying Field, where they learned to control and maneuver their powered machine and taught themselves to fly. And at the Wright Brothers Aviation Center, the 1905 Wright Flyer III, flown at Huffman Prairie. The Wrights' final bicycle shop and home were moved from Dayton in 1937 to Dearborn, Michigan. So, looks like the Wrights are still flying across the country. A bonus of visiting the park is the Paul Lawrence Dunbar State Memorial. Mr. Dunbar, a friend and neighbor of the Wrights, authored novels, short stories, lyrics, and over 400 published poems. The Dunbar House was purchased by Dunbar for his mother in 1904, and he passed away a couple of years later. In 1936, the house became the first state memorial to honor an African American. The title of Maya Angelou's classic book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, is taken from Mr. Dunbar's poem, Sympathy. A favorite Dunbar poem of mine is When the Old Man Smokes. In the forenoon's restful quiet, when the boys are off at school, when the window lights are shaded and the chimney corner cool, then the old man seeks his armchair, lights his pipe, and settles back, falls a-dreaming as he draws it till the smoke wreaths gather black. And the teardrops come a-trickling down his cheeks, a silver flow. Smoke or memories, you wonder, but you never ask him, no. For there's something almost sacred to the other family folks in those moods of silent dreaming when the old man smokes. Ah, perhaps he sits there dreaming of the love of other days, and of how he used to lead her through the merry dance's maze, how he called her little princess, and to please her used to twine tender wreaths to crown her tresses from the matrimony vine. Then before his mental vision comes perhaps a sadder day, when they left his little princess sleeping with her fellow clay. How his young heart throbbed and pained him, why the memory of it chokes. Is it of these things he's thinking when the old man smokes? But some brighter thoughts possess him, for the tears are dried the while, and the old worn face is wrinkled in a reminiscent smile. From the middle of the forehead to the feebly trembling lip, it's some ancient prank remembered of some long unheard-of quip. Then the lips relax their tension, and the pipe begins to slide, till in little clouds of ashes it falls softly at his side. And his head bends low and lower, till his chin lies on his breast, and he sits in peaceful slumber, like a little child at rest. Dear old man, there's something saddening in these dreamy moods of yours. Since the present proves so fleeting, all the past for you endures, weeping at forgotten sorrows, smiling at forgotten jokes. Life epitomized in minutes when the old man smokes. The American Hiking Society offers alternative breaks for college student groups, volunteer trail stewardship projects. It's part volunteer work project, part outdoor vacation. Check it out at AmericanHiking.org. Do something different. Since everything old is new again, use an old slang like far out.